The information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice or treatment. If you're concerned about your health in any way, we encourage you to consult your GP.
People don't like talking about it, but incontinence can affect anyone. You may have a friend or relative who lives with it every day, or maybe you're worried about your own incontinence. Incontinence Talks is here to make us all feel more confident about continence, hosted by former Olympian rower and Coloplast ambassador Pete Reed. In this episode, Pete talks to consultant microbiologist Dr. Carmel Curtis to find out more about urinary tract infections. Dr. Curtis is an expert in UTIs, something which affects a lot of ISC users.
Carmel, nice to see you again, and I've been looking forward to this enormously. Why are we talking about UTIs and why are they such a big deal?
Thanks, Pete. Thanks for inviting me. We're talking about urinary tract infections because they affect so many people. And I think they are an under-talked about subject. I think they are something sometimes people are embarrassed about. And I think some people really struggle with diagnosis and treatment. So for me, they are extremely common, about 3% of all GP interactions. They're about a fifth of all hospital infections. So they are, you know, quite a high priority, I would say, for certain members of the healthcare profession.
How long have you been working in the UTI space, in microbiology?
Yeah, so I've been a consultant in the NHS for 13 years, and I've had an interest in UTIs, particularly in patients with neurological issues, for at least the last 10.
Is there anything you think you haven't seen in this space?
Oh, there's always something you haven't seen, okay. I would say.
Seen, smelt, monitored, all the things. I have suffered from UTIs in the past and recurring UTIs. I've heard you speak on this subject twice, actually, and I was just drop-jawed and fascinated because the science that you were communicating and showing data about was what I'd been feeling in myself as I'd got to know my new body post-injury, but I didn't have the skills to understand what was going on. Is this something that our listeners who perhaps have never had a UTI, is it something that they should be aware of and thinking about? Why should they be listening into this as well?
Because I think, particularly in people who have cord injuries or who use urinary catheters, a UTI is a very real fear, even if they haven't had one themselves. So I think from the perspective of a person who thinks, well, why should I care about it if I haven't had one yet? But I still think for many patients that I speak to, the worry is, will I get one and what will I do and how will I know and will someone diagnose me and will someone offer me treatment? If I have that treatment, will I get better? So I think it's significant because it's common, because people have worries about it, and I think people worry about how they access diagnostics, treatment, prevention. So I think those for me are the main issues for patients.
Do you think that there's a stigma?
I don't think it's so much a stigma. I think people can be quite flippant about it.
Okay, so there's a public perception thing.
Yeah. So the thing, I include healthcare professionals in that. So, oh, it's just a UTI. It's just cystitis. What's the big deal? You know, drink loads of water, drink cranberry juice, get some antibiotics, don't worry about it. So I think in actual fact, it's the opposite. I think in many cases, we don't take it seriously enough.
So that's kind of reassuring for me to hear, because that's been my experience as well. So my spinal cord injury was in 2019. There's clearly a lot of change. There was for me, but anyone that has a spinal cord injury to a lesser or greater extent has to learn their body again.
Yeah.
And lots of people externally, they just see the wheelchair or just see whatever that is visible and wrongly assume that legs not working or arms not working is the biggest part. And there are scores of things that I would like to have back, but the tippy top of my concerns is UTIs. So I self-catheterize, which we'll come to. My bladder, my renal system doesn't work, so that's the bladder, kidneys, I'm just going to say pipes, but you're going to say urethra and give us all of the big names. The plumbing doesn't work for me, so I need to put something foreign up inside my body to drain the bladder, and bladders weren't designed for that. They're designed for sort of filtering and out.
They are self-voiding, in other words.
Yeah, self-voiding, thank you. Is the bladder, is the renal system a very delicate organ? Is it in a fine balance?
Well, it is in a fine balance because it's obviously connected to the kidneys. So the whole point is the kidneys filter the blood, generate waste products, send those down to the bladder. So it's robust in the sense it's got to work every single minute of every single day of your life, pretty much, to be efficient and to keep you in good health. And when it goes wrong, you feel the impact. And that's part of what you're describing. So you're not in renal failure as such, but you have a bladder implication of what has happened to you with your spinal cord injury.
So the bladder implications aren't just, oh, there, drink some cranberry juice, have plenty of water, you'll flush it out. It's not, they are the worst aspects. So I need to ask you some questions about my medical care, which is really indulgent, but I've got an audience with you. It's because when I have a UTI, firstly, when they start off, I'm in denial. I think that's probably not a UTI. Maybe it's some sort of trauma. Maybe pushing something up inside me is irritating some lining and causing a few spasms.
Yeah.
What I noticed quite soon after that, how mine present is, actually my wife, Jeannie, she notices that I start to get smelly.
Mm.
So like a body odour, armpit smelly. And I notice that I get physically weak. So my just power using my arms drops by half. I get very fatigued as well and sweaty, yeah, shivery, fevery. I seem to sleep and sleep. And then the part that I was unsure of is, I don't know if this is psychosomatic, but I think differently.
Mm.
Like I get, my speech is even less coherent than it is now. And my thoughts are as well. And it's the only time in my life that I feel any sort of despondence. Where can a bacterial infection affect the way you think?
Well, it can, I suppose, in the sense that it can, the normal balance of your electrolytes. So those are things like the salts in your blood and in your urine, things like your glucose, how much sugar you have. Bacteria can do things like disturb those effects, particularly if they get into the bloodstream. Now, not everybody who has a urinary tract infection gets a bloodstream infection, thank goodness. But I think it can affect you in the form that you can be dehydrated, therefore you get lightheaded, you don't feel quite well. Particularly in older patients, they can get something called delirium, where they're very confused and they almost forget where they are. They can become, you know, to the point where they need to be hospitalized. So I think one of the things with urinary tract infections is it affects people in very different ways. And so when you see it in a child, it will present very differently to an adult, to a person of older age, to a person who might have a spinal cord injury or a person who might have something like MS. And I think that's why it's, for me, quite important that you recognise it in yourself, because you or your close family members like Jeannie will know you better than a lot of other people. And when you say, I don't feel quite right, I think I might have a UTI, it has been my experience that particularly patients with MS or Parkinsonism, where I had sort of started my interest in this, would report that nobody believed them.
Right.
They would describe a very unique symptom. I'm just going to give an example in an MS patient that I saw, where they would drag their leg. So the spinal lesion they had would cause a leg drag. And they usually knew that that meant they had a UTI. That was how they presented.
But when they told that story to their GP or someone, they might just think, nah, surely
might not. Might get dismissed. Or they might think they were having a relapse of their MS, for example. They might think actually that leg dragging sensation was a neurological deterioration, a deterioration of their nervous system. But actually it was a UTI in their case. And over time, that patient that I looked after would say, oh, I always know when they're coming on because I get the leg weakness. So what you're describing is not an uncommon scenario, particularly people who have cord injury or neurological causes for their UTIs.
So there's a massive spectrum.
Massive.
Which means that somebody's on the left-hand edge of the spectrum where they've got a UTI, but it's not bothering them too much. So we don't want to be all doom and gloom.
No, exactly.
Kind of reassuring that, okay, it's not normal to have reoccurring UTIs that are making you bedridden, but also we shouldn't live in fear too much.
Correct.
And it's a normal thing if you get a UTI. It doesn't mean you're dirty. It doesn't mean you should be ashamed. And it can be that it just hurts to pee and that
you need
to drink
more. And you've just been unlucky. So if you think that 50% of all women will get a UTI at some point in their life, which is an enormous number. And a lot of that will be associated with, you know, intercourse, with childbirth, with being pregnant, with postmenopausal. So it's really, and a lot of people have no real issues with it. They get 2 or 3 days of antibiotics, they feel great. So I agree with you completely. I think there are certain people for whom it causes more problems than others. And I think it's that spectrum exactly as you describe.
If we dig into the mechanics, the urethra, female urethra, is still part of inside your anatomy.
And very short.
And it's very, very short, yeah. Right? I didn't really realise, but what are we talking?
3 or 4 centimetres long.
Okay, and, yeah. And a male urethra has got a long way to go.
Correct, which is why men are less prone to UTIs in general.
It's important that we do bring up male and female differences, because there might be a societal thing as well. Is there any difference in stigma or getting treatment for females than males?
Yeah, so UTI should be rarer in men. So often when a doctor or a specialist nurse sees a man with a UTI, they actually take it more seriously because they shouldn't really be seeing it, which I think is quite interesting. So if a young man came with a urinary tract infection who had no other medical history, there would always be quite a serious thought, what could be going on here? Is it related to something else? Could there be, for example, a kidney stone there? There'd be a different thought process. I think my personal view is because they're more common in women, you may need to have a couple of extra UTIs before somebody goes, you know, I wonder if you have a problem. And of course, loads of women won't. It'll just be, I've just had a baby, or I'm pregnant, or I'm postmenopausal. So I think there is a difference in that sense. And we also treat them slightly differently. Men get longer courses of antibiotics than women because they're considered more complicated.
That's interesting. Can we talk about the dipsticks as well? We haven't mentioned those yet, yeah. But as someone with a spinal cord injury who catheterizes, so I've got a predisposition, I suppose. What are the dipsticks that I'm talking about that we put some pee onto? What are they showing?
So they show different things. They're not all the same, but generally when you are considering whether somebody might have a UTI, you're looking at a couple of things on the dipstick. One is the white cell. So when your bladder encounters bacteria, it produces white cells,
yep.
Which are to sort of protect you from the bacteria, to, if you like, chomp them up and remove them. And then the second thing they often test for the dipsticks is something called nitrates, and that's something relating to bacteria. So those are the two classical things we would look at.
And these are normally UTIs. They're normally used by healthcare professionals.
Correct.
Maybe a urology nurse in the GP surgery. So you'd go, they'd ask you to produce a sample and then in the first instance dip it. So let's say the dipstick is lit up, high in leukocytes and nitrites, maybe some blood in the urine as well.
Yeah, sometimes.
So the sample will go off to a lab. Would it come to somebody like you?
Well, it would come to my laboratory.
Okay.
So we're a place like a hospital, an NHS laboratory, typically. It would be put through a laboratory process. So it would have a more sophisticated level of a dipstick, which is essentially a microscope, would look to see, can I see the leukocytes? Can I see any bacteria or yeast floating around? Then it would get cultured, and then it would get antibiotics tested against it. And then it would come to me for what you'd call medical authorization. So I look at the name of the patient. I look at whether they're male or female, if they could be pregnant, are they a child? And then I would look at what bug they've isolated, and then what antibiotics I'm going to release to the GP or to the specialist nurse, who will then decide what antibiotic to give you. And of course, I would, you know, I don't know whether you're allergic to an antibiotic, so that would be for them to assess.
Well, actually, I don't mind sharing, but I am. So I'm allergic to penicillin,
yeah.
Which is a little bit of a personal problem because it halves the number-ish of antibiotics that I can use. And we will come on to that. I'm desperate to ask, is there a threshold? So once the analysis has been done and the case has come to you, you said you have to make a decision. And presumably these are quite tough decisions sometimes, because there must be a threshold where you say sometimes it's there or thereabouts. So it's a yes or no. What are the parameters that you're considering of whether or not you prescribe or say, yeah, this is a positive test or a negative test?
Yeah. So we have national standards for this in the UK, which most laboratories will use. They're a bit controversial at the moment, and they're undergoing a review, whether we're too strict. In other words, more people have UTIs than we report. The standard is actually from the 60s, the 1960s. So we've been hanging on to the standard for a really long time. So I think laboratories will have a standard that they look at. They will decide this is meets the threshold of we have enough bugs in this urine to call this positive. And then that comes for a medical review to assign the antibiotics you might want to give out. For example, there are certain antibiotics we wouldn't give out in pregnancy or in very small children or in people with penicillin allergy if we have that. So I think that is where the microbiologist looks and decides, I'm going to release these five antibiotics to the GP and he will choose the one best fit for his patient or her patient.
So we're getting to something here, which is what's the burden on the healthcare system of UTIs? Because you'll be prescribing something, and I really want to hear your experiences and thoughts on prescribing antibiotics, pros and cons, and resistances to antibiotics as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is the seminal question of our age, really. How many antibiotics should we be giving out and why should we protect them? And the burning question across the world, which you're hinting at, is antimicrobial resistance. So in other words, every time we expose a member of the population to an antibiotic, we worry that the bugs that they carry in their gut or in their mouth or on their skin is going to change because we've given them an antibiotic. Now, most of the time, that's not a very significant change. And when we choose our antibiotics, we're always trying to choose the antibiotic that will do the least amount of damage to the rest of you. So we want an antibiotic that's going to concentrate in your urine, that we're hoping it's not going to affect your gut or the bacteria you have in your mouth or in your skin. So we try to choose things that will do the least amount of damage to your normal bacterial, because we're all covered in bacteria, head to toe, inside and out.
And we need it too, right?
And we need them. So we don't want to take away any of the bacteria that make you feel healthy, that help you digest your food or metabolize your drugs that you might be taking for something else.
Because the danger is if you gave me a whacking great dose of a nuclear
broad spectrum antibiotic,
then how would you expect me to feel?
Well, I think the issue is you might not necessarily feel very different, but I think that what the microbiologist is doing is thinking about, I want to least affect the rest of you. So large doses of broad-spectrum antibiotics are unnecessary for a lot of people with UTIs. And we try to preserve them for the day that someone comes in when they are truly unwell and they need to be admitted to hospital and they need to have intravenous antibiotics. We try to keep those really broad-spectrum antibiotics for those moments, not give them out in the community unnecessarily.
Carmel, I've got a question about antimicrobial resistance. Mm-hmm. That's the right phrase, isn't it? AMR?
It is.
How worried should we be about this phenomenon globally? What is it and what's your advice to listeners?
Yeah, so AMR is a global threat, I would say, to healthcare across the world. And in different countries, in different parts of the world, it has a greater or lesser presence. We are actually quite lucky within the UK that we have superb agencies that monitor this, that give us guidance on what antibiotics we should be prescribing for our patients and for people in the community to reduce the risk of AMR. So we are fortunate that we have these excellent surveillance systems where we can look and see who might have resistant bugs. You're correct to highlight it as a wider issue, but for many people as individuals, they won't feel the impact of it themselves.
So your advice to individuals?
Is to take antibiotics when you need them, guided by a healthcare professional, I think is the key message for me.
So do you have peers around the world in various different laboratories where there's a network of and a decision-making process with all of your joint brains of this is the direction and things we should be worried about? And
no, it's something that has taken quite a high priority in healthcare systems around the world. We truly live in a global society, so we know that things don't stay in one country. They move around with tourism, with business, with food products, with agricultural products. So we are very conscious of this movement of resistant bugs around the world. So many countries who have the resources will have these surveillance systems and these ability to pick up resistant bugs moving around the population. And we take all of that into account when we give advice about what antibiotics a person should have.
Are we making any more antibiotics? Is there a finite number? If I said how many are available to treat a UTI?
This is an interesting question. We are doing better than we were, I would say, a few years ago. So there had come, a point, a hiatus, a kind of full stop in antibiotic development, because for drug companies who would invest enormous amounts of money in the development of antibiotics, resistance was being acquired so quickly that they weren't making a return on their investment. So they were very reluctant to produce drugs that people only needed for very short periods of time. So if you think about high blood pressure, you're on a drug often for your whole life. So that's very profitable. It makes sense for people to invest in, for example, cholesterol drugs or antihypertensive drugs. But of course, that's not really the case for antibiotics, because you're not on them your entire life.
That's heartbreaking for me to hear.
Mm.
Because I'm not making this political, but that's a little bit of capitalist mentality of what's making money. And I'm sure that's not the only problem in your industry as well. Yeah. UTIs, renal systems, it's not a sexy topic of conversation. How is funding for everything, for scientific development?
Well, I'd have to say, of course, I'm biased. I'm disappointed at how low down the political agenda things like urinary tract infections often are. They affect large numbers of people, but as you say, compared to some other pressures on healthcare, I suppose viewed less importantly, maybe lower down on the political agenda, which I think it's why it's so important that those people who suffer from UTIs and people who are interested in the treatment of UTIs continue to raise profile, to do educational things like this, to discuss it, with their GP, with hospital colleagues, in my case, trying to raise the importance to say that people who have UTIs can be affected to such a degree that their lives are changed by it. And I don't think that we really have done ourselves any favours in describing that particularly well in healthcare. I think we're much more aware of what to do if someone has cancer, if someone who might have dementia or HIV or tuberculosis or other things, we're very clear about what we're going to do, how we're going to treat them, how serious it is. So I think UTIs have somewhat suffered from that lack of scientific investment and interest.
And if there are individuals in the right-hand edge of the bell curve with how debilitating UTIs can be, it'll affect what work they can do, how they're able to contribute to society, work, pay taxes, be normal and functioning. And the big swing is they could become an increasing burden on the NHS and on healthcare systems. Again, I don't want to fearmonger at all. How much of your time is spent on podcasts, spreading awareness, on panels, speaking to government, speaking to health ministers, just to get the message across from the pointy end of science, what this phenomenon is now and going forwards?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I feel quite passionate about. I do what I can. I speak with various charities I think have been very strong in this space.
Can you talk about those?
Yeah, people like the MS Society, Parkinson's charities, dementia charities are asking us all to not forget about their patients, their friends, their families. They're looking at, you know, for example, if a person with dementia gets a UTI, it can entirely cause them to have a significant deterioration, takes what little quality of life they might have and diminishes it further. So from my perspective, I think the more we can do in terms of articles that people can read, podcasts, you know, talks at events, charity events in particular, I think is really key, because this is not the easiest topic to get up the political agenda. So I think that's why, you know, I wanted to participate today, and we've known each other a while, Pete, but I think we cannot allow people to feel like this is not a significant topic, even though I couldn't go to work, I couldn't socialise, I couldn't go to my child's graduation, or, you know, there could be some event that people scars them almost, the feeling that they've been left, you know, because they haven't been treated, they've been left out of what they consider to be the vital parts of their lives.
So that's so well said, and I think it's important that when we speak to the decision makers, that they're not making decisions out of charity for people. It's not just that they can't go to a wedding or a funeral. Those are the very real things that affect people's lives. But it's every right to be top of a healthcare agenda alongside many other worthy causes, and shouldn't be ignored or dismissed to cranberry juice and staying hydrated or not being hygienic when you have sex or other foolish taboos that are in the background of anything to do with UTIs. So thank you for your continued lobbying and support and talking and sharing about the subject.
On our next episode, Pete continues his chat with Dr. Carmel Curtis about the risks of urinary tract infections and how to minimise the chances of getting one as an ISC user. There are lots of amazing charities that can provide focused support depending on your particular needs, as well as lots of information at collarplus.co.uk. Thank you for listening to Incontinence Talks, and remember to consult your GP if you have any worries about your own continence.